For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Good morning. I want to give a short introduction about myself, just so you know something about me. Great family photo that was taken recently by a friend of ours. I always like having good photographers. That's my husband, Scott, and our kids, Sophie and Matt. Sophie is 11 and Matt is 9, so they're 5th and 3rd grade. That picture is true to height, except for my husband, because he's 6'5", so he was like crouching down behind us so he wouldn't tower over us. But yeah, Sophie's always telling everybody how she's almost as tall as I am, which is not that hard. She's also in the same shoe size that I am. In fact, we're getting to the point where I should soon be getting her hand-me-down shoes because she's going to outgrow them. Scott and I have been married 15 years. And so yeah, that's my family and I love them. So today, the vision is that we want to build a relationship with our kids as parents, that we're not here just to tell our kids what to do and direct them, but to take a relational approach. And really the overarching goal is to relate to our kids the way that God relates to us, because we want our kids to learn how to build a relationship with God, because that's ultimately going to be what directs them for the rest of their lives. And if you think about how God relates to us, I think that this sums it up really well in Psalm 27. The psalmist says, "My heart has heard you say, come and talk with me." And my heart responds, "Lord, I am coming." And so God takes a very relational approach with us. He wants to have conversations with us. He wants to hear from us. He has things that he wants to say to us through his word and through different experiences in our lives. And so when we think about parenting, we should think about it the way that God approaches us, talking and listening and really just growing close to each other in that way. And if you think about it, when it comes to listening, you know, ever notice how much the Lord lets you talk? That when it comes time to your time with God, you know, he will let you just go on and on and on without interrupting. He loves to hear what you have to say. And it's really refreshing when we have the chance to just pour our heart out to him. And do you ever notice that he doesn't step in and just correct you right away? You know, if you sat down with the Lord and you were like, "I am just so frustrated at what happened at home last night." And if you were like, "Well, you know, you really shouldn't be feeling that way. And if you thought about it from the other person's perspective, you would really try to be more loving." You'd be like, "Well, great. Then I'm not even sure why I want to talk to you about this." Instead, what he does is he lets us talk. And that's really what the Psalms are. If you read them, it's just God listening to the psalmist. And the psalmist usually talks himself into truth as he kind of talks through the situation. And so a lot of times what you'll find is God just lets you do the talking, and if he steps in with a word of correction, it's after a period of time, and it's usually very gently in order to kind of direct your thinking. And you'll find that as you talk with God that you'll kind of be like, "No, I don't think that that's right, what I'm saying right now." But you kind of need to get it out there at first. You know, we may have learned listening skills with our friends. Maybe you've read some books on it. Maybe you've gotten some feedback on ways that you listen well or don't listen well. And so we try really hard to listen well when we're with our peers. But you ever notice how some of those listening skills go right out the window when you're with your kids? There's things that we seem capable of doing when we're with our adult friends, but then we get around our family and it gets a lot harder. And I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. You know, some of it is we're with our kids since they're babies, and it's not like you're really listening to them and developing listening skills when they're 6 months old. And so some of that just continues right on as they get older and they get more verbal. But of course, there's also just higher pressure when we're with our kids. You know, it's easy to kind of put on your listening face when you're with your friends for an hour or two at a time. But when you're with your kids all day, every day, or for whatever portion of the day that you're able to be with them, and they're coming at you constantly, and they're certainly not practicing their listening skills with you, it gets a lot more difficult to do this. And so we wanted to take some time to go through some practical tips. We're going to start with the idea of listening, because that's sometimes the harder part to do with our kids. And I have a ton of examples that I'm going to be using out of this book, How to Talk So Your Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. And like I said, I'm starting with the second part first because I think that's the harder one for me. This is not a Christian book. This is a secular book. We actually have copies in the back if you guys are interested in getting a copy. It's a great book because it has a lot of pictures. It also has a lot of exercises that I found to be very helpful. And, you know, the authors, Adele Faber and Elaine Maslisch, they were not like child psychologists or anything. They were just moms who listened to a child psychologist and felt some of his ideas were very helpful. And so they started putting together workshops back in the 70s and going around and talking to people about these various tips. And it kind of became this huge phenomenon. This book is an updated version with a foreword by one of their daughters who's grown now. And so it's just one of those things that they thought was helpful, and it turns out to be very helpful. The one thing I will say about this book is, because it's not a Christian book, they are anti-spanking, and they're pretty strong on that, as are most parenting books. And that is not my philosophy. If you're interested in hearing what I have to say about that, I actually gave another care group talk on disciplining our kids that included why spanking is good in a certain age, and that's on the website, and you guys can find that. But other than that, I think that this book is excellent and helpful. You know, Solomon, if you read Proverbs, it talks about how he searched the whole world, and he was willing to take worldly wisdom and kind of give it a Christian perspective. And so, you know, we're going to use this because I found it to be really good. So, how to listen. Helping with feelings is the very first section that the book talks about, because our kids, as they're maturing, they have lots of different emotions that they're going to be experiencing. And our goal as parents is to try to help them figure out what they feel, but also what to do with all of those feelings. And whether you have a kid that, you know, is just out there and expressing their emotions all the time, or whether you have a kid that's maybe more reserved, either way, they're gonna have a lot of emotions that they need to know what to do with. And in fact, I found that people who seem less emotional, they often have more churning on the inside than they realize because it's not being expressed. So I like what Faber and Maslisch have to say. They said, when I'm upset or hurting, the last thing that I want to hear is advice, philosophy, psychology, or the other fellow's point of view. That kind of talk makes me only feel worse than before. Pity leaves me feeling pitiful. Questions put me on the defensive, and most infuriating of all is to hear that I have no reason to feel what I'm feeling. My overriding reaction to most of these responses is, oh, forget it, what's the point of going on? But let someone really listen. Let someone acknowledge my inner pain and give me a chance to talk more about what's troubling me, and I begin to feel less upset, less confused, more able to cope with my feelings and my problem. Now, I will say that the goal is not to validate every single feeling that a person has, and the goal is not to say that it's okay for them to feel whatever, but the goal is for them to be able to express and explore what some of those feelings are without immediately getting shut down by the person who's listening. And again, I don't know why that's harder to do with our kids. I think some of it might be that I worry that I'm going to have like a bad kid or something, and so if one of them gets really upset, I think, don't get upset, because then you might do something that's really bad, and then what are people going to think about my parenting? So it's often kind of a self-focus or maybe an identity thing for me. We're trying to help our kids find their own way and learn skills in order to deal with their emotions, and so we have to kind of take a broader view than any one interaction that they have, any one reaction that they have. And so that's what some of these tips are associated with. So the very first thing in helping with feelings is that we need to make eye contact and listen with our full attention. Again, this can be difficult because we're busy. I usually have 5 different things coming at me at the same time. Now, as I walk through the house, there's usually at least 2 voices calling out to me, Mom, 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 Chris, Mom. You know, and then the dog needs something, and then the phone goes off. And so the idea that we're going to sit down and focus can be really difficult, but that's especially hard today with all of the devices that we have. Catherine Steiner Adair, she wrote a book called The Big Disconnect, Protecting Childhood and Family Relationships in the Digital Age. And she's being quoted all over the place because she's done a bunch of research on our smartphones. She says, for her book, she interviewed more than 1,000 kids from the ages of 4 to 18 and talked to hundreds of teachers and parents. So this is research-based. One of the many things that absolutely knocked my socks off, she says, was the consistency with which children, whether they're 4 or 8 or 18 or 24, talked about feeling exhausted and frustrated and sad or mad, trying to get their parents' attention, competing with computer screens or iPhone screens or any kind of technology. Much like in therapy, you hear kids talking about sibling rivalry. Kids don't feel like they're competing with their siblings anymore for the parents' attention. They feel like they're competing with their parents' phones. And you read stuff like this and you're like, I could see that. You know, my phone goes off on a pretty regular basis. Or I'll have that moment where I'm like, I just have to check that one thing really quick. And then the next thing I know, I'm sitting in the dining room as my kids are doing things and, you know, my thumb is going. And I'm thinking, what am I even doing right now? It's not even anything important. You know, most times I'm on social media because I just had to look up that one thing really quick. And it sucks my attention away. And so we've made a very conscious effort to try to limit our phone use in order to actually be available to our kids, because the point is you never know when they're going to try to talk to you. And they've done a lot of research that shows that the more moms especially have their phones out, the less available they are to their kids, and kids need extended interactions in order to be able to form a bond. And so I've done a lot of different things, and I'm still working on this. I actually got that Stay Focused app that will kick you off of social media after a set number of minutes. I haven't actually activated it yet. It's only tracking my use because I'm like, oh yeah, I should do that. And yet I kind of don't want to. But I've turned all the notifications off on my phone except for texting, because I don't need to know every time somebody liked something on Instagram or every time somebody sends me an email. Otherwise, I'm just going to get sucked into that. So making sure that we are aware of this temptation and finding ways to limit it, because we need to be able to not just hear what our kids are saying to us, but actually turn and let them know that we are actively listening. So eye contact, really important. And then a few other tips. This is where we're going to start getting into some things with the book. A lot of it is cartoons, which was really helpful for me. I thought it was going to be kind of cheesy. I actually like the fact that the drawings are not that good, because it makes me feel like I'm not a completely incompetent artist, although they're still far superior to what I would be capable of doing. But I'm just going to take you through some of the different cartoons that they have in this book of suggestions that they have. So helping with feelings, they said, sometimes it's really tempting to use questions and advice when our kids come to us with problems. And so one example that they give, so the little girl comes in and she says, somebody stole my new red pencil. Well, are you sure you didn't lose it? I didn't. It was on my desk when I went to the bathroom. Well, what do you expect if you leave your things lying around? You've had things taken before, you know. This isn't the first time. I always tell you, keep your valuables in your desk. The trouble with you is you never listen. Oh, leave me alone. Don't be fresh. And so here's a mom. She probably genuinely wants to help, and yet what does she do? She immediately starts questioning her daughter to try to figure out what her daughter did wrong, which makes her daughter feel pretty shut down because she's really just upset that she lost that pencil. And so they suggest, instead of questions and advice, that you should acknowledge with a word, to say less when our kids come to us with problems. And the words that they suggest are, yeah, oh. That's really all that you have to say. And so again, that interaction, somebody stole my new red pencil. Oh? I left it on my desk when I went to the bathroom and someone took it. That's the third time I've had my pencil ripped off. I know. From now on, I'll leave the room. When I leave the room, I'm going to hide my pencil in my desk. I see. It actually is really helpful because it kind of makes it seem like you really don't have to know what to say. You can just say, oh, or I see, when you have no idea what else to say. I don't know about you guys, but when I don't know what to say, I find something to say, and it's usually not the right thing to say. And so just eliminate a lot of those words. And the point is, the daughter needs to figure out what is going on and how to fix this problem herself, because the mom is not there with her to help her. This is happening at school. And so just giving her kind of space to talk about the fact that she's upset, but then there's something that she could do about it, takes a lot of pressure off the situation, and the daughter's not going to feel like she's being corrected in this specific situation. And also notice, it's about a pencil. So it's not anything really high priority or very important to figure out right away. We could probably get her another red pencil, or she can buy her own. And so the mom is just kind of backing off and letting her talk. It lets the daughter know that the mom actually cares about what's going on in her life and trusts that the daughter has the ability to kind of figure things out. Another point they say is it's tempting to deny our kids' feelings sometimes, especially when they're strong feelings. I think it can get a little scary that maybe this feeling is going to overtake them or they're going to be like really disturbed by this bad feeling. So in this example, the daughter's saying, "My turtle's dead. He was alive this morning." "Oh, no, don't get so upset, honey." And then, "Don't cry. It's only a turtle." And so this is probably the dad's very genuine but very awkward attempt to try to comfort his daughter. And look what he's saying. "Don't have those feelings." To which she gets more upset and starts crying really hard, at which point he gets frustrated and he says, "Stop it, I'll buy you another turtle. I don't want another one." Well, now you're just being unreasonable. Because he's thinking, "Well, I tried to comfort you and it didn't work, and now you're even more upset, and just forget it. This whole interaction is going terribly." Again, I think we can relate with this because we're really trying to help, and then if we help in this way, sometimes it makes our kids feel worse, at which point we feel worse about how things are going. So instead of denying the feeling, they suggest giving the feeling a name. Your kids know that they're feeling something, but they usually don't know what it is. And they know that they're feeling bad or they're feeling good. Those are about the only feelings words that they have. And so we as parents are trying to help them figure out what they're feeling. And so we can kind of take guesses a little bit. And so redoing that interaction, she says, "My turtle is dead. He was alive this morning." And dad says, "Oh, no, what a shock. He was my friend." "I know, to lose a friend can hurt." So right there, he names the feeling. "That hurts. That's painful. That sounds sad." To which she then goes on and opens up more. "I taught him to do tricks." I don't know what that means. I don't know what turtles can do tricks, but it sounds really cute. He says, "Yeah, you two had fun together. I fed him every day." "Yeah, you really cared about that turtle." And so in this example, you know, instead of feeling shut down and therefore getting more upset, the girl feels like she can continue talking about her feelings. Now, this one can be a little bit tricky because sometimes I'll try to give the feelings a word and my kids are like, "No, that's not how I feel." At which point I can back off and be like, "Okay, I'm sorry, that was the wrong word." Sometimes I'll ask them, "What do you think you feel?" Again, they usually say bad, and that's about all that they can give me. So you can take kind of a questioning posture with this one sometimes to ask them, "Do you think it's this? Do you think it's that?" But the goal is not to get it exactly right. The goal is not to label the feeling exactly correctly because, again, our kids are young and immature, and so they don't know. The goal is just to keep them talking and to feel like they can be honest about things that they're thinking and feeling. Especially when it's something really negative. You know, those are hard feelings to deal with, and so just to give them room to express it makes them feel like it's okay to feel this, and honestly, it kind of resolves the feelings more quickly, which is helpful for them. Sometimes our kids want something, and we have to say no, and so we explain to them the logical reason why it is that they can't have what they're having. So in this example, at breakfast, "I want my Toasty Crunchies." "Well, we don't have any, dear." "I want them, I want them. I just told you there aren't any in the house." And so mom is trying to explain, "You know, you want Toasty Crunchies. We don't have any Toasty Crunchies." Sometimes I'll add on to the explanation because I haven't gone to the grocery store yet, or because you ate the entire box yesterday in one sitting, or whatever it is. And I'll try to help the kid see, it's not that I don't love you, but this just isn't going to work out right now. At which point the kid gets even more upset. Mom's like, "Well, how about some Nifty Krispies?" And he's like, "No!" And then the tantrum. And now you're acting like a baby. Now, where does this come from? Well, a lot of times, I don't mean to not give my kids what they want, but I can't always provide. Also, have you ever noticed that kids just say what they want all the time? We could have taken our kids to Kings Island the day before, and if we drive by Kings Island or see a picture of any amusement park, Matt especially is like, "I want to go to Kings Island." To which I think, "I just spent $40 to get you into Kings Island yesterday, plus we bought all the food there, and do you not appreciate what I've already given you? And are you going to be disappointed with me and think that I'm depriving you in some way if I don't take you to Kings Island?" It's the same way with DQ or any other ice cream place. We could have gone there an hour before, and then we drive by, and they're like, "Ooh, DQ, I want to go." And so I think This is all very logical that they've reasoned out in their minds. It's actually lower brainstem, okay? When they see something that they want, they're like, ooh, I want that. And they're not considering all the ways in which I have tried to give them special things. They're not considering, does this sound unappreciative? They're just thinking, ooh, I like amusement parks. And that's really all that they're expressing. And so we move in with the logical explanation. They're not using logic when it comes to their desires. They're only expressing how they feel. And so instead of using explanation and logic, you can give a child his wishes in a fantasy. Okay, this sounds cheesy, but it surprisingly works. I want my Toasty Crunchies. I wish I had some for you in the house. I want them. I hear how much you want them. I wish I had them now. I wish I had the magic power to make a giant box appear. Well, maybe I'll have some Nifty Krispies. Oh. I forget about this sometimes, and then my husband will remind me to do this, and it works really well. I want to go to Kings Island, and I wish we could go every day. And then they're like, okay, and then they move on. Now, I don't actually wish that we could go every day. Secretly, I hate amusement parks, and I found a way to not go anymore. They just give me a really bad headache, and you know, it's not good for anybody for me to go to those. But to pretend that I want to go is just fine. And what I'm acknowledging is not the logic of the situation, but just their desires. And wouldn't it be great if we had every desire met all the time? I mean, not in a realistic way, but you guys know what I mean. You're just, oh yeah, cool. I wish we could do that. And then they move on because they just want it acknowledged. And so this works for just about anything. I wish I didn't have to eat this dinner. Well, wouldn't it be nice if you got what you wanted all the time? And you have to say it in a way that's not snarky. You know, you can't be making like sarcastic jabs at your kids, but aren't there things that you wish all the time that you didn't have to do? And wouldn't it be great if somebody was like, yeah, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had self-cleaning bathrooms? Wouldn't it be great if no mud ever got tracked into the car? That would be great. I would love that. And so maybe their desires are a little bit less mature than mine, although as I say that, I'm wondering if their desires are any less mature than mine. Mine are pretty immature. But, you know, I know the reality of the situation. And what's great about this example is it's not the mom setting the boundary. She's not saying you're not allowed to have Toasty Krispies or whatever the name of the cereal was. Reality itself is what was coming to bear on this kid. He wanted something. It wasn't available. He has to learn how to deal with the fact that he's not always going to get what he wants. And the mom is not saying, you can't have this, you're not allowed. Now, obviously, I have a category for that. And again, the goal of this talk is not how to set up boundaries with our kids, how to discipline them. I think that's a whole nother category. I think that there's times when we don't have to do that because other situations are going to come to bear and that's going to be sufficient. And so in this situation, mom is letting reality itself be the boundary and helping her kid deal with that, and in a way that's not going to inflame the situation. And so a few other tips for finding ways to listen to our kids is to also add in focused one-on-one attention when possible, and to do dates with our kids if we're able. Now, my husband and I have two kids, and so we just have two time slots every week, Sunday afternoons and Tuesday evenings. And so we're just able to switch, which is pretty easy, but we do it every week. And it's a chance to just get one-on-one time with the kids. If there's more than one kid, then oftentimes the mom will be the one to make the sacrifice so the dad can get some focus time with the kids, especially if he's out of the house more. But, you know, sometimes there's creative solutions available, and maybe it's not every week, but if it's a regular thing, what's helpful about dates is it provides the space to have conversation with our kids. This is not something we ever would have come up with, but people who had gone before us strongly advocated it, and we put it into place when our kids were very young. We started doing one-on-one dates when Sophie was 2.5 and Matt was 1. And when they're little, you're just trying to find something to do to get out of the house. It's not especially relational, but you're setting up the habit so that your kids know this is something that's going to happen. And then the whole point of dates is if there's something to talk about, that's often when it comes up. And so what Scott and I have found is that 2 out of 3, 3 out of 4 dates, nothing happens. You know, we'll go, there'll be chit-chat about stuff. Matt and I will often park at the top of Walhalla and walk down to McDonald's, and the whole time he'll just be talking about his imaginary game where he's jumping over stuff. And that's all that happens. But every once in a while, you'll get a nugget of something really helpful from your kids where they'll ask a question about something that they're wondering about. Sometimes really profound questions. We've had discussions with our kids about race, about poverty, about sex, because they're moving into that age and they're starting to notice things about violence. Other times it'll be stuff just going on in their heads, things that are happening at school. And it's sometimes only a 5-minute conversation, but it's a window into what's going on in their lives. And so those dates provide that opportunity. And like I said, it's not a regular thing. Last night, Sophie and I had our date and nothing happened. You know, we talked about the wits that she was eating. And that was the extent of the depth. But there have been times when she has opened up with me. And it makes every frustrating date in the past where nothing happened and it took all my energy just to keep them out of the house for an hour, it makes it worth it to have those moments. You can also share what's going on in your life. If you're trying to get your kids to talk to you, peppering them with questions is not necessarily going to be effective because they might feel a little bit like you're prying, you're coming at them too hard. I found, and again, this is something that I just kind of stumbled into, but I found that it actually should work a little bit more like a friendship where I can tell them things that I'm thinking about. I mean, that's what Jesus says in John 15 to his disciples. He says, I no longer call you servants because a servant doesn't know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends. For everything that I've learned from my Father, I have made known to you. So he's like, I'm going to start sharing with you guys things that are going on and thoughts that I have. And this actually happened this past week where Matt and I were on our walk and I was trying to ask him questions and it wasn't really going anywhere. And then I just told him, because this is what I was thinking about, you know, I've got this teaching coming up on Wednesday. And I'll be honest, I don't remember what happened after that because it was just, there wasn't anything especially profound, but it got a conversation rolling. And so simply finding ways to be honest about what's going on in our lives can help. It's also really helpful to do something to get them talking, especially with boys, but I think this is true for younger kids in general, that a sit-down, face-to-face conversation is not going to accomplish anything because they can't pay attention for that long. But if you're out moving around, going for walks, some activity, coloring, anything with crafts that doesn't take a ton of attention, sometimes that kind of frees their brains up a little bit so they can start talking. This happened to me maybe a month and a half ago where my husband was out of town on a retreat and, you know, the kids were kind of picking at each other. Matt especially was having a really hard time. And so I kept saying, well, do you miss Daddy? And he wasn't giving me anything. And so then out of sheer desperation to get the kids to stop fighting with each other, I was like, Matt, why don't we just go outside and throw the football? And so we're out in the backyard and literally two tosses in, he's like, I miss Daddy. And then he was fine for the rest of the evening. This is something that our junior high and high school workers already know. This is what they do during some of their discipleship time is they get the kids out moving around and that gets them talking. Bedtime, it takes wisdom. Sometimes it's kids just wanting to stall. And so you don't want to give in to that. You want to have boundaries and they do need to go to bed. I don't know about you guys, but by the time 7:30, 8 o'clock rolls around, I'm completely exhausted and I'm thinking just please go to bed so I can stop talking for a little while. But what's hard is sometimes when they get into bed, that's when their brain slows down enough that they can think about things. And you'll sometimes get really good conversations with them when you're tucking them into bed. And plus, isn't that when they're the cutest? You know, when they're in their PJs and their teeth are brushed and, you know, they're actually lying still for a little bit. So I don't think it has to be every time they go to bed, but we should be praying that the Lord will show us what to do. So how to listen. All of this is under grace. That I listen to talks like this and I think, well, I have not listened very well. I didn't listen very well this morning. I haven't listened very well this week. There was that one time last month that I think I listened really well. It can be discouraging. But when we think about things from God's perspective, He is aware of all of our struggles and weaknesses as parents. In fact, that's what Jesus says in Luke 11. He says, if you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? There's something kind of comforting for God to say, you know, you guys are just evil in your hearts sometimes, and yet you are still able to give good things to your kids, but how much more does your Father want to do that? And so he is not saying that we need to be perfect parents in order to be able to love our kids. I can't remember what parenting book I read it in, but one thing that stuck out to me was that the goal is to be a good enough parent and to just try and to have an open heart and a learning attitude, because we're under grace when it comes to our parenting and our entire lives. And this idea of being under grace, it's not some nebulous idea that sounds really nice. It's an accomplished fact. Being under grace means that we are reconciled to God and forgiven by him for all of the things that we've ever done wrong, including in our parenting, because of Christ's work on the cross. That's what Paul says in Ephesians 2. He says, it's by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. And so God says, I know that you have weaknesses, but I also know you have failing, and I know you have sin, and that's something that I want to forgive you for. And not this ongoing, you know, you have to ask for forgiveness over and over, but a one-time reconciliation to God through Christ's work on the cross. That if we're willing to admit our need for him and to ask for that forgiveness, he freely offers it. That it's a gift that he wants to give each person. And so that's something that can help our parenting, is to admit over and over again, God, I messed up again, but you have already paid for this. You have already accepted me because of your son. And so I don't have to be afraid of asking for help, because I'm already willing to admit that I need you. So how to listen, I think, an important part of our parenting. But in the remaining time, I do want to talk about ways to talk with our kids, how to talk. Because as much as we want to build a relationship with them, we still need to guide them. We still need to give them instruction. We still need to make sure that they are acting in certain ways that are acceptable. Our goal is not to raise hoodlums who are just running around doing whatever they want all the time. And so in this section, I do want to focus on how we can communicate with our kids when we need them to do something, to obey in some way, or to stop doing something. One idea is just to be kind. This is a fruit of the Holy Spirit, that there are ways that we can talk to our kids in which we're not just bossing them around all the time. We're not constantly being frustrated with them. We're not nagging or picking at them. You ever notice sometimes that you talk to your kids in a way that you would never talk to anyone else? It's kind of embarrassing. And so I try to pray on a regular basis that God would give me kindness as a fruit of the Holy Spirit. And so things like using requests, saying please and thank you, it communicates respect to our kids, that we value them as people, as individuals, as somebody separate from us. And so instead of telling my kids to do something, I try to ask them to do things. And, you know, we'll get into ways that you can repeat requests so you're not nagging them. And so being kind, I think, not only communicates respect, it will also keep you from those really embarrassing moments when you overhear your kids talking to each other or to other kids, and you're like, God, I can't believe how they're talking to each other. That's so rude. I think that's my voice. You ever have that happen where your kids are saying something to each other and they're being like super bossy, and you're like, I know who that sounds like. And so trying to introduce a certain amount of respect and kindness can be very helpful. But here's another one that we have really appreciated, and that is to say it with a word. What does this mean? Well, instead of this, I've been asking and asking you kids to get into pajamas, and all you've been doing is clowning around. You agreed that before you watch TV, you'd be in pajamas, and I don't want to see a sign of anyone doing anything about it. I use my words all the time to try to get kids to do stuff, and the more frustrated I am, the more words that I use. At which point you can see them kind of glaze over, because they just need to wait until I'm done talking, because they really don't want to hear what I have to say anymore. And it's really ineffective. So instead of going on and on about what you want them to do, try this. Kids, pajamas. She's obviously already talked to them about it. They have not listened. And so there is a certain emphasis to the word. You know, it's a slightly more, in fact, louder, a louder word, but it's one word. And so it's not yelling at them, but it's making it clear we need to do this right now. So, PJs, I actually would prefer to say PJs than pajamas because it's even shorter. The shorter the word, the better it is because you can just say it. Here's words that come up in our house all the time. Kids, shoes, lunch, coats, and our favorite, door. Why is it my kids only hold the front or back door open when it's above 80 or below 30 degrees? Have you ever noticed that? It's like, just close the door. But saying it this way, it's a reminder, and it's not haranguing them. And so it catches their attention. What I have found is that boys and girls respond to this differently, and it turns out it's because girls can hear better. And so I found that I feel like I'm yelling at my son all the time. It's because he can't hear me. And this is a medical fact. It's not because he's not paying attention. It's not because he's not respectful. It's because their ear canals are shaped differently. And so about a week ago, I started prepping for this talk, and you know, some conflict had come up in my marriage, and then I was helping a girl work through some anger problems that she had, and my daughter, who listens to everything that I say, was coming back to me later saying, oh yeah, that's really cool how you were talking your girl through her anger problem, and you know, when you yell, that's really hard for me. To which my son was like, when do you yell? And I'm like, I mean, I guess not as often as I thought I did, so that's good. But saying things more loudly can be helpful as long as it's not actually yelling at them. But notice too, that keeps you from saying something you're gonna regret. Because when I start adding in more words, sometimes I say things that are not as kind as I would like it to be. And so keeping it to one word and reminding them of what it is that I need them to do kind of catches their attention, and then they move on. Another point is that if you're getting frustrated, just tell them. You can be honest with them about your emotions because they can tell anyway. You know, your kids can read you really well. They probably know you better than almost anybody else because they're with you all the time and they're constantly watching and gauging and evaluating. And so honestly, for me, sometimes the frustration comes in later because I've tried too long to hold it together and to be really nice about everything, when the truth is I'm getting kind of frustrated. And so if they are fighting with each other, if they are not listening, if they're doing something that's like really disruptive or annoying, it's actually been helpful sooner in the process to turn to them and say, this is really frustrating right now, and I would appreciate it if we stopped, or something to that effect. And saying it that way, sometimes even with the feeling coming into the words themselves, you know, they're going to be able to tell, and it keeps me from holding it together and then kind of losing it. You know, I'm able to be patient for maybe one or two rounds of whatever it is that's happening. And by the third or fourth time, I'm like, okay, everybody stop. Whereas if I had just said something a little bit earlier, it could have short-circuited that whole process. I just finished this great book called You Are Not Your Brain. Again, secular book, but they've done all this brain research about ways that people respond. But the one part that I found really interesting was they actually would put women into a room and have them watch a disturbing video and then talk to each other afterwards about their emotional reactions. And they had all sorts of, you know, implements all over these women to measure all different things about their body. Well, one thing that they did was they had women watch this disturbing video and then specifically try not to share what they were feeling. And they would watch the women's blood pressure just spike as they tried to hold back their emotional response. Even more interesting, if a friend and I were in this study and we watched the disturbing video and then they had me try to hold back my emotional response, her blood pressure went up. Because people can tell when somebody's not being honest with them about what they're thinking and feeling, And that feels kind of unsafe. It's like, what's going to happen? And so with our kids, we can be honest with them about ways that we're feeling. And the sooner we do that, the more it's just going to be an open communication. And again, we're trying to be kind. We're trying to hold our tempers. But our kids are tough. They can handle negative emotions. They can handle us being affected negatively by them, as long as we're learning to express that in a way that's helpful, instead of just trying to hold it together all the time. Okay, but here's another great thing. We can also apologize for when we don't get this right. And I think that communicates a lot of respect to our kids too. It also validates, you were affected negatively by me, and I want to let you know that it's okay for you to be upset by that. You have to apologize in the right way though. Compare this, I'm sorry I got angry, but you weren't listening. With this, I'm sorry I got angry. I was frustrated that you weren't listening, but I should not have lost my temper like that. Will you forgive me? Ken Sandy, in his book, The Peacemaker, he's got a bunch of examples of the first one with the word but in there, and he argues it just emphasizes the second half of the statement. And so if we're going to apologize, we need to do it legitimately, own up to where it is that we've been wrong, and it will teach your kids how to forgive, too. I grew up in a family that did not apologize ever, and it's surprising how difficult it is to apologize to anyone, but especially to my kids. So the first several times I tried to apologize, I either could barely get the word out, I'm sorry, or I would say it in just the lamest way ever. But I have had many opportunities to practice, praise God. And so I've gotten a lot better at it. And sometimes my kids forgive me right away now. Other times they're like, you can tell that they're still upset. And so I give them some space. But, you know, this is something that happens in our family now. And I'm really glad that the Lord has taught me how to practice this. Giving kids choices can be really helpful too, if we're trying to secure cooperation, trying to get them to do things. Are you in the mood for your gray pants or your red pants? Okay, what's being communicated here is you're putting your pants on, but which ones do you want? And that gives the kids opportunity to feel like they're not just being told what to do. Would you like a half glass of juice or a whole? Now, that seems like a reasonable thing. We're leaving in 5 minutes. Do you want to go on the slide one more time or on the swing? Or another way that I'll put it to my kids is, do you want to leave now or do you want to leave in 5 minutes? And if they say in 5 minutes, then 5 minutes rolls around and I say, well, you said that this is when you want to leave. You kind of make it seem like it's their idea at that point. But the parent is still in complete control because they need to go. And you know, if you give a heads up, then that'll make it easier and it'll kind of prepare them. Or this one, what would work best for you, doing your practice before dinner or after? Again, that practice is going to happen because you are the parent and you are in control, but you let the kid pick the time. And I have started doing this more with my kids and it's worked really well. Do you want to make your lunch now or do you want to make it after you play for a little while? And then they pick. Now, I will say we have also learned to secure cooperation up front. Do you want to make your lunch now or do you want to make it after dinner? I want to make it after dinner. Then do you agree to do it after dinner without complaining? At which point they're like, yes. And then they start to complain. I'm like, mm-mm, you agreed to do it without complaining. Now, I'm not saying these are magic tricks and you're always going to secure cooperation and it's going to go really smoothly, but it makes it easier. And again, and it kind of lets them know this is something that's going to happen. So giving them choices. There's like a myriad different ways that you can do this. And again, it kind of helps kids from feeling like they just need to rebel against us all the time because every aspect of their life is being controlled. They feel like they have a certain amount of say. And then the final point under how to talk is just to try to pick the right battles. I have to check on this on a pretty regular basis because I grew up in a pretty strict household, and so there were a lot of rules. And so now I can't always tell. Am I being overly reactive to this? Like, we have a deck on the back of our house. We trash picked a couch. And so that couch has been sitting out there. That couch is nasty. If people come over to our house and they want to smoke, they go out and they sit on that couch. Well, there are times when Matt doesn't want to play out in the yard because it's raining. So what he wants to do is toss the football and jump on the couch as hard as he can. And I just hear the couch slam into the back of the house. And it kind of drives me crazy because I'm like, oh, this is so much noise and chaos. And so there are times when I go out there and I'm like, no jumping on the couch. You need to go somewhere else. And my husband is like, that's a trash picked couch on the back of the house. He could probably jump on it. To which I'm like, you're right. Why do I care about this couch? Honestly, it's kind of an ugly couch. And if it breaks, it means that we can get a new used couch, which I will probably like better anyway. Another big one for me, my kids make their lunches every day when they get home from school. I literally can't be in the same room as my kids making their lunch because kids are not efficient, kids are not clean, and watching my son make his peanut butter and jelly sandwich, nobody wants to be in the room for that. The amount of peanut butter that he puts on the bread, and then he'll leave some on the knife and like clean the peanut butter off the knife with his finger and then lick it and then scooping the jelly, and it just stresses me out. And the whole time I'm like, this sandwich is gonna be a mess and this kitchen is gonna be a mess. And then he comes out from making his lunch and he has peanut butter and jelly all over his chin. And I'm like, you didn't even eat it. I don't understand what's happening. But I have to remind myself, but he's making his own lunch. And he does this every day, and that's, you know, pretty good for a third grader. And so I just need to ignore that stuff and not be picking at him all the time. Our kids' job is not to be efficient. Our kids' job is not to know how to do things. They need to do things badly in order to learn how to do things well. And so making sure that we're not nitpicking at them all the time, but really focusing on the important things. There's so many other things that we could discuss about how to listen or how to talk. I am not saying you should go buy this book, but what I am saying is every once in a while a parenting book will come along that gives me something different than what I read in most parenting books. And I did find that this is one of those books. They've got a lot of tips in here on how to secure cooperation for our kids. They've got tips in here on, you know, how to praise our kids in ways that's actually effective. I found it, again, to be really helpful, very practical, and very realistic. If anything, sometimes you'll read these comics and you're like, well, I don't always sound like that. So, you know, they're being honest about how it is that parents talk to their kids and how they get frustrated with them, but alternatives that they could put in place. So just to wrap up, a few conclusions. One is that parenting is an art. It's a skill. And so it takes practice. Even preparing for this talk, I was like, oh yeah, there were things that we were doing a year ago that I've forgotten about, and there were tips that I really put into practice, but then I kind of lost the way on that. But there's also things that I'm like, oh, I don't think I do that one very well. And so just viewing it as something that we can always be working on as opposed to something that we're going to arrive at. And with that, God wants to enable you to grow as a parent. The parent that I am today is not the parent that I was a year ago, and hopefully will not be the parent that I am a year from now. I want to continue growing in my effectiveness as a parent, and God really wants to enable us to build strong relationships with our kids. Your goal is not to be your kid's best friend for the rest of your life, but you do want a friendship with them. You want a relationship with them where they can share what's going on in their life, where you can share what's going on in yours. And yes, this will change with different stages, but this is something that we should be shooting for. And it's the way, like I said in the beginning, that God relates to us. And so he will teach us how to become more like him as we relate to our kids. So that's what I have for today. We do have some time for comments or questions. Sherry's got microphones. So if you just want to hold your head up. Okay, how about right here in the back to start?
And then also we found a set of keys if someone's missing their keys.
That's important.
I have a first grader who really loves to talk, but he really only wants to talk about like Minecraft or like a TV show or something like that. And he'll go on for 20 minutes about Minecraft. Mm-hmm. And it literally just makes me want to like ram my head into the wall. Uh-huh. So I'm wondering how I can escape those conversations, yes, but still let him know that I'm here for like real conversations. Is there a way to escape those conversations? Maybe is, you know, I want him to know he can talk to me, but I don't really want to talk about TV shows.
Or you know, movies. That's a great question. And we have definitely gone through different phases of that. The Pokemon phase, where I'm hearing descriptions of every single card. My kids, within the past year, for some reason, have gotten into Garfield comics. And so they're constantly trying to read Garfield comics to me or quote them because they have them memorized. So one thing that I, and it's hard because I want them to tell me what they're interested in, but at the same time, I agree. I'm like, we've been talking for 20 minutes about Garfield and I'm so bored and this is kind of driving me crazy. Plus Garfield's kind of snarky. You ever notice that? So one thing that I've tried is, okay, you can tell me two more things about Garfield. Or you can read me one more comic, or we've got 5 minutes left on Pokemon, and then we're going to start talking about something else. And so, you know, they want to talk about it because they like it, but at the same time, let's be realistic that they can't just go on and on about this thing that it does not involve the other person. And so just some simple boundaries like that can be helpful. Yes.
Okay, so someone told me about that giving kids choices thing, like red shirt or gray shirt, a while back, and I ran with it. I like gave choices for like a lot of things. So they felt like they had some sort of control or whatever. And then I met another lady, and we just got in a conversation. She's like, I used to do that. And she was older than me. Our kids were older. She was just reflecting on her parenting. She was like, I used to do that all the time. And people say it's like such a good thing to do. She said, but I noticed, and obviously this depends on like the kid or the family, like my kids, then they didn't always want to listen when there wasn't a choice, or they wanted to be like, but I don't want to do that. Or like they felt like maybe they started feeling like they always could have a choice about things. And I'm like, oh my God, my kid does that. And so I think that that can be good. But I think for me, what I've noticed is it's good to have a balance with that. Like, I mean, I think I overdid it at first, and then my child just didn't listen very well, you know, because he just didn't like not having a choice. But, you know, we all know it's not always realistic to have a choice about everything. So I just kind of cut back on that pretty purposefully. And but I still, like on things that don't matter, you know, what like the shirt thing or whatever. Here and there, I'll sprinkle those in. And I do think that the listening has gotten a lot better. And just emphasizing the importance of, like, listening to mommy and daddy the first time. And, you know, and some Bible verses to back that up. But I think it's good to not overdo it.
And, you know, that's a good point, that it's within very specific boundaries. And you're right. Sometimes they don't have a choice. They just need to do this thing. And they need to listen. And, you know, like one thing we'll do for choices is my kids can pick whatever cereal they want for breakfast, but it's always the same three cereals. And so they can pick if they want Bran Flakes or Cheerios or Frosted Mini Wheats. And if they want something beyond that, I'm just like, no, these are the three cereals that we have. And so you're right. It has, we have to be creative in the way that we apply it. And it also depends on the kid, too. Some kids will find ways to try to push the boundary all the time, and maybe you need to bring it back a little bit. Sometimes kids, you'll see that they are getting really routine, and you can push it out a little bit. So you're right. That would be a great example of where this is more an art than it is a science. Yeah, back here. Oh, was there one up there?
It's a call. I just wanted to share something about bedtime talking that I found that has worked. I read it in another book where you ask them, what was one hard thing from today? What was one good thing from today? And then you briefly talk about what's happening tomorrow, since they, you know, adults, we have planners and all that, and it makes life easy for us to grasp what's coming ahead, but that gives them a framework overnight. Then you don't have the battle of, I have preschool again today.
Yeah.
You know, that's really helped us. And it just talk reminded me of that. And I haven't done that in a while.
I know. Another reminder. That's a great idea. I heard the what's one hard thing, what's one good thing. And, you know, sometimes it's just the most random stuff, but it at least gets them talking. Yeah. Is there one back there?
Hi. My struggle is I have a very talkative 4.5-year-old and a 3-year-old who is like a little like struggling to talk. And I kind of like been trying like different things like, hey, let's, you know, take turns talking. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I don't want to feel like I'm not going to listen to my 4.5-year-old talking. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't want her to feel like I'm giving all the focus to my son. But at the same time, I need to like encourage him to talk because that's what's happening. Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't have the space and time to talk. So how do I balance that and not make my daughter feel like I'm not going to listen to you because you're just like constantly mm-hmm. talking?
No, that's a good question. My kids were like that when they were younger. My son did not talk at all until he was almost 2. And the pediatrician's joke was that speech therapy for him would be taping my daughter's mouth shut because she just talked for him all the time and there wasn't space. I think it is appropriate to say, hold on, it's your brother's turn. And teaching her how to listen. So then, you know, what would be cool about that actually is then it's not just you taking turns listening to them, but you trying to get them to listen to each other as well. And so if there's times when you notice that he's trying to talk, letting her know, hold on, we're gonna give him a turn. But then I think if using that eye contact, like we talked about in the beginning with both of them, will let her know the times when you're trying to get her to hold on a second, it's not because you don't want to listen to her. It's because she needs to give space. Okay, well, if you guys have any other questions, I can stay for a few minutes afterwards. And then do we have everybody pray or do I just pray? How do you guys
pray.
Okay, I'll pray for us then. Well, Lord, we are really grateful for the kids that you have entrusted to us. We just want to recognize here, Lord, that they really belong to you. And we want to deliver them to you, of workers who love you and want to serve you. And so pray that as much as we're able in our limited capacity as sinful, forgiven people, that we would model your love to them, that we would learn how to build relationships with them so that they're able to share openly and honestly about things that they're going through. And just pray that we would be people that talk to our kids like we talk to other people, that we would be respectful and kind with them, and that you would bless us with awesome relationships with the kids that we love so much. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.